Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within London's West End. Today's episode is about the death of Marianne Moriarty, a good, decent, and hard-working mother of 8 children who struggled to protect her family whilst trapped in an abusive relationship with a violent, angry drunk. And with no way of escape, her pain was only ended by the blade of an axe. Murder Mile is researched using original sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 71, The Last Days of Marianne Moriarty. Today, I'm standing on Drury Lane, WC2, two streets south of the lonely spinster Daisy Edith Wallace, one street east of the brutal baker Alexander Moyer, two streets northwest of the murder or suicide of Italian banker Roberto Calvi, and just 50 feet from the home of Carl Taylor, the little-known first date killer. Coming soon to Murder Mile. This is the Wild Street Estate. 13 six-story sandstone buildings covering a whole city block from Drury Lane to Wild Street to Kemble Street. And as one of the early Peabody estates, built in 1881 by philanthropist George Peabody to provide clean and safe inner-city housing for the city's poorest in the Victorian era, even today, it still houses hundreds of families. Hidden in the really shitty part of Covent Garden, far from the surly servers serving lukewarm lattes for £8, the opera house, where poncy uptight types feel cultured having watched a fat woman warble, and the overhyped street performers, who have 1 hour to fill and just 2 tricks to perform, so most of their act is about making you clap. With no sun, no flowers and no joy, just long lines of monstrously drab, flat-fronted high-rises, this side of Drury Lane is a real eyesore. Oddly, the Peabody estate is old and interesting, as before the slum clearances of 1875, somewhere amongst what was once a dark and dirty rabbit's warren of leaky lodging houses, cowsheds and cesspits, stood 13 Granby Place. And although it has long since been demolished, the area still hangs with an unpleasant sense of dread, terror and death. As it was here, on Saturday the 7th of December 1872, having suffered yet another brutal beating at the hands of her drunk and abusive husband, that armed with an axe, the cruel and tragic life of Marianne Moriarty came to an end. In 1831, Mary Ann Donovan, known as Anne, was born near the town of Kilmallock, County Limerick, in the southwest of the Republic of Ireland, as the third eldest daughter of 13 siblings. Like many peasants who lived off the land, they were illiterate and poor, eking out a hand-to-mouth existence, with peat moss on the fire, animal fur for clothes, and eating only what they could grow, surviving in the rugged windswept wilds with a dearth of sunlight and a sodden boggy soil on a small holding barely big enough to feed their family and few animals. They lived off root crops like potatoes. In 1845, as an infestation of potato blight swept across Ireland, infecting every farm and family, the Great Famine saw 4 years of mass starvation, disease, and emigration, which killed over 1 million people, an eighth of the country's population, and forced another million to flee. After 2 years of hardship, the decimated and emaciated Donovan family had emigrated to England. But London in the late 1840s was a far cry from the farmlands of Limerick. With hard stone streets, a festering river of feces, the acrid air thick with choking industrial fumes, and the water so polluted that one cholera outbreak would soon wipe out a sixth of Soho in a single week. So living in a leaky, flea-infested lodging house with five other families, the Donovans had survived starvation, but only just. Having moved to London, although illiterate and unskilled, Mary Ann made the best of her new life. By all accounts, Mary Ann was a good Catholic woman, with solid morals, strong maternal instincts, and a natural warmth which endeared her to others. In the spring of 1851, 20-year-old Mary Ann Donovan married 23-year-old Daniel Moriarty. A stocky, stout, and thick-set Irish bricklayer, with arms like tree trunks, fists like prize hams, and a nose like a squash spud, having broken it in too many fights. And although a fan of drink, he worked hard. During those first few years, married life was good, but hard. As being Irish, poor, and reliant on his wage, they moved from job to job and place to place. And although Mr. and Mrs. Moriarty tried to raise a family, being little and weak, the first two babies of their brood failed to survive their first year. But being devout Catholics, the couple kept their faith, and soon enough, 8 children followed. In 1871, after 20 years of marriage, Daniel and Mary Ann were living at number 3 Brown's Buildings, just off Drury Lane. And with their eldest, 17-year-old Mary, in service as a maid, squeezed into just 2 tiny rooms was their eldest son Danny, aged 14, John, aged 10, Edward, aged 8, William, aged 5, and with a sixth on the way, with Mary Ann as a full-time mother, they struggled but survived. She adored being a mum, but married life was never bliss. As with her sweet smile broken by smashed teeth, her soft flesh mottled by purple welts, and her greeny blue eyes red raw and puffy from years of tears, Mary Ann lived in fear. But before the year was out, the life of Mary Ann Moriarty would be over. And all because of her violent husband, his addiction to drink, and an axe. By the summer of 1872, the Moriarty family had moved to 13 Granby Place. 2 tiny damp rooms, on the second floor of a leaky tumble-down house, squeezed in a thin unlit alley, hidden amongst a cramped chaotic mess of slum lodgings, cowsheds, coal yards and slaughterhouses, with thousands of people all sharing an airless rat-infested courtyard for washing, cooking, bathing and shitting. scraping by on a meagre wage. Marianne made the best of a dire situation. For her beloved family, there was always fresh straw on the two beds they shared, hot food for their rumbling bellies, and being devoid of trees, she kept the log fire burning by chopping up old bits of discarded wood with an axe. But as hard as she tried, they never had enough, as Daniel always blew his wages on drink. Daniel Moriarty was a drunken, loutish brute. After 3 decades of chronic boozing, his fierce face was a bloated red mess. His gut was like a flatulent balloon. His glassy, scowling eyes were vacant. And with his hard, hairy knuckles, all bruised and broken, although he had a family to feed, always being drunk, he never had a kind word to say, a penny to spare, or new clothes to warm his ragged family. Not only was Daniel a cruel husband, a bad father, and a selfish drunk, he was also a violent criminal. In 1867, 5 years earlier, Daniel violently robbed an elderly couple in Covent Garden, beating them black and blue with his fists, breaking the man's jaw, and all for the sake of a few pennies. Sentenced to 7 years in Millbank Prison, Marianne was left with no income, 5 kids to fend for, and a sixth on the way. But being resilient, with a sympathetic landlord, George Beals, having taken pity on the good woman's plight, she moved her family to cheaper lodgings at 13 Granby Place. Daniel served only 3 years in prison. He was placed on bail and returned to his wife, his kids, his job, and his drink. In April 1872, Daniel was sentenced to 1 month's hard labour for what the court termed as ill-treating his wife. Risking her own life, Marianne filed a complaint against her husband at Bow Street Police Station, as in one of his frequent drunken rages, the brute had rained down several heavy blows upon her, fracturing her eye socket, cracking 3 ribs, and breaking 2 fingers. As shielding her children with her arms and back, she defended her newborn baby with her body. Daniel served 1 month in prison, and fueled by drink and resentment, again he returned home to his wife and kids. In June 1872, having boozed himself insensible at the Wheatsheaf pub on Stanhope Street, as a serial womaniser and brothel botherer, at a little before tea time, Daniel came home and demanded that his wife and 6 hungry children wait outside in the street so that he could fuck the whore that he had paid for. In October 1872, at the Bull's Head pub on Vere Street, Daniel and his old pal, John Sullivan, had boozed themselves into an incapable stupor. A fight sparked up, they were turfed out, and stumbled back to 13 Granby Place. Having forcibly ejected his family from their own home with a brusque, "Woman, out!" Daniel grabbed a candlestick, knocked his pal to the floor, and robbed him of 23 shillings. Tried at Bow Street Police Court, Marianne gave evidence against Daniel. As being a violent ex-convict who had broken his bail terms, facing a prison sentence of up to 10 years for robbery, this was Marianne's chance to escape. Only with the victim, his pal, John Sullivan, having recanted his evidence, and later stating in court,
"I know nothing about it. I never saw the man."
Daniel Moriarty walked free. On the bitter winter evening of Thursday the 21st of November 1872, with her eyes black and swollen like ripe avocados, her lopsided mouth a misshapen mess of broken teeth, and with 7 of her starving children in tow, including a malnourished toddler on her hip and a newborn at her breast, with both of her parents dead and her siblings scattered far and wide, 40-year-old Marianne sought sanctuary at the Holborn City Road workhouse, having been kicked out onto the icy streets by her husband. Sadly, Marianne had become a familiar face at the workhouse. And although she was a neat and sober woman, who worked hard to earn a warm bed, dry clothes, and hot food for her babies, as safe as the workhouse was, it wasn't home. Having stayed for 9 days, she knew this was just a brief respite from the beatings, and being reliant on her husband, she begged him to take her back. On Tuesday the 3rd of December, Marianne returned to 13 Granby Place. Again, Daniel was drunk. Again, Daniel was angry. And again, Daniel beat her. As with two broken fingers, a sprained wrist, and the axe's blade blunt, as the dark nights drew in, the wood was gone, the fire was out, and his dinner was cold. Marianne could have filed another complaint at Bow Street Police Court, but she didn't. On Wednesday the 4th of December, having squandered the bulk of his weekly wage at the Weed Sheaf and stumbled home drunk, as the petrified family sat in silence, for fear of feeling the hard slap of his rough hand, finding fault in anything she did, Daniel's anger snapped. Being broken, bloodied, and bruised, it was only after she had put her babies to bed, with a reassuring hug and a sweet kiss goodnight, that in private, she allowed herself to cry. Again, Marianne could have gone to the police, but she didn't. On Friday the 6th of December, one night before the murder, as Daniel and his pissed-up pals necked back a few pots of ale at the Weed Sheaf, with the family famished, Marianne sent her son to beg his boozy father for money to buy bread. With a hard slap, 7-year-old William was sent back empty-handed. And yet, oddly, staying till closing time, Daniel splashed out on a half-gallon jug of beer to take home. Staggering past his starving family, Daniel stumbled upstairs with his pal John Kay and sunk several more beers. Gone midnight, with her kids unable to sleep, owing to the banging and raucous cheers, Marianne asked Daniel to come home. Seething at her impertinence, he snapped,
"Woman, out!"
But she didn't leave. Fuming at her insolence, he spat,
"Out, now!"
Again, she didn't. But as his fast fist tightened, being too tired to give her the beating that he felt her cheek warranted, he hurled the half-full ceramic jug at her head. It smashed, split open a gash on her forehead, and soaked her ragged clothes in a pint of warm stale ale. Being wet and humiliated, Marianne left and went to bed. And although Daniel was too drunk to follow her, by the next morning, he would not have forgotten. The next day was Saturday the 7th of December, 1872. At 5:30 a.m, Marianne rose her children. The oldest boys earned a half shilling a day as porters in Covent Garden. En route, Edward lugged back a sack of coals for the fire. William struggled to chop a wood with a badly blunted axe. And Marianne nursed her two babies, while she busied herself with a never-ending series of chores. They all worked hard for the sake of the family, all except Daniel, who snored. That morning, as a demeaning part of her weekly routine, Marianne popped to see her sympathetic landlord, George Beals, to apologise for being late with the rent. He was a generous man, kind and compassionate. So had it not been for his big heart and the pleas of Marianne, the family would have been evicted weeks ago. But now, being 7 weeks behind, they had to pay up now, or the family was out. A bitter winter had begun, and as a Siberian wind blew down Drury Lane, It froze everything it touched, freezing the water pump shut, the wash house solid, the icy cobblestone slick, and dangling from the leaky roofs of Granby Place were lethally sharp shards of ice. Being denied a home, food and money, if they were drenched by the rain and frozen by the wind, she knew her youngest wouldn't last a day. Daniel had the money. She knew that, and for the sake of her children, she needed it now. But by the time she had returned home, his bed was empty, the purse was missing, and her husband was gone. Nursing a blinding hangover, as plumes of stinky, sweaty steam rose off the wheezing bulk of Daniel Moriarty, his guts gurgled, his arse parped, and his gob burped, as with his heavy purse clinking with coins, he stumbled down Kemble Street and, to quell his throbbing head, staggered into the nearest pub. And there he stayed all day, necking back pots of beer, chugging back shots of rum, and only moving on when the obnoxious boozer was booted out. Edward was 9 years old, and William was only 6, and yet having raised her children well, Mary Ann trusted her boys implicitly to look after her young ones while she went in search of Daniel. She was alone, afraid, and still black and blue from the beating she had received several nights before. By 2 p.m, Daniel was drunk again. Sat at the bar with his pals in the Wheat Sheaf, the stocky, stout and powerfully built bricklayer slugged back a pot of beer clutched in his big bruised fist. And seeing his wife enter, he scowled,
"What?"
Mary Ann pleaded,
"You've given me no money today."
To which Daniel quipped,
"No, and I don't intend to give you any."
Spitting ale in her face as he left. Although she shook, as she stared at the seething, brutal drunk who had beaten her almost every day of her married life, with his selfishness once again risking the lives of her children, the hungry hole in her empty belly was replaced by a fire. And as a strong woman who had given birth 8 times, Mary Ann Moriarty stood her ground, as she was angry, determined, and unwilling to back down. Shaming in public this bad dad and shitty husband in front of his cackling pals, Mary Ann shouted,
"Is this how you intend to treat your wife and children, is it?"
Hammering home his faults, she let the whole bar know about the 7 weeks' rent and their 8 kids. Only he brushed off his wife's blather with a,
"Mind your own business, woman. Don't interfere with mine."
And ordered another pint. Only he couldn't. As having heard enough, and being absolutely disgusted at this man's behaviour, Patrick, the landlord of the Wheat Sheaf, turfed Daniel out of the pub and ordered him home. Shortly afterwards, George Beals, their landlord, saw Mary Ann propping Daniel up as he stumbled home, spitting her name and swearing at his witch of a wife, as from his gurgling guts he spewed a steamy spray of hot sick onto the icy street. And with her face all filthy, looking as if she had fallen, as they disappeared into the darkness of Granby Place, he thought nothing more of it. As for them, this was normal. Moments later, their neighbour John Kay found Mary Ann slumped against the street door of 13 Granby Place, as with 2 broken fingers, a sprained wrist and 3 cracked ribs. This time, she couldn't drag her spouse's 20-stone slab of flab up 2 flights of stairs. Hearing her baby's crying, John Kay carried Daniel up to the room, popped him in an armchair, and left for work. At roughly 2:30 p.m, Mary Ann arrived at Bow Street Police Station, her filthy face speckled with fresh bruises, a bloodied lip, and a swollen cheek, as once again, she made another statement to the police. At around 3 p.m, Mary Ann returned home. Daniel was drunk, furious, and tense. Knowing where she had been, He seethed.
You lying bitch. You've been to Bow Street, as usual. I'll give you cause to go there.
As an ex-con who had broken his bail and faced an even harsher sentence, as Daniel grabbed Marianne's hair, he pulled her closer, and as she fought to shield her screaming babies with her body, tightly gripped in his battered fist, Daniel held the axe. In this kind of neighborhood, where death was a daily event, violence was to be expected, and screams were commonplace, as the heavy axe fell, nobody took any notice of Marianne Moriarty. At 7 p.m., as John Kay entered the drab gloom of 13 Granby Place, the eerie silence was punctuated by stifled sniffles and muffled tears. And as he passed the second floor landing, he saw the Moriarty kids, the eldest comforting the youngest, too afraid to re-enter the room. With the boys safe, grabbing a candle, John lifted the latch and pushed open the stiff wooden door to the two-roomed lodging occupied by the Moriartys. Except for the flickering fire, the sitting room was dark. And as he approached, slumped in an armchair, he saw the black silhouette of a woman. Raising his candle, even by a shaky limited light, he saw that her silent face was an unsightly mess of welts, lumps, cuts, and gashes. And with fear in his voice, he asked what he already knew to be true.
Mrs. Moriarty, I'll be damned. If you ain't killed the man...
Breathing rapidly, as the brilliant whites of her glistening eyes peeped through a thick, crusty mask of dried blood, trembling with a mix of terror and euphoria, she stammered,
"Yes, I am the woman that done it. I had reason for doing it, and a good job too."
As lying on the floor, partially sprawled across the blood-soaked bed, with his head wrapped in a bedsheet, was Daniel. The police arrived at 7:45 p.m, tending to the motionless corpse as Constable Firth pulled open the matted bedsheet, its sticky layers slowly pried apart to reveal a bloody mess which was once a man's head. But now, like a pound of minced beef, it was split apart by six wounds made by an axe. After 21 years and 8 children together, having endured an endless barrage of assaults, abuse, fear, and broken bones, being failed by the legal system, ignored by society, and condemned by her faith to live a life in an unbreakable marriage with a violent, womanizing thug, desperate to protect her babies, having snatched the axe, Marianne had finally escaped her brutal, drunken husband. Or so she thought. When red bubbles popped from the gaping holes of what was once his nose, as Daniel wasn't dead, but very much alive and still breathing, PC Firth hailed a cab and dashed him to the hospital on the Strand. Andrew Duncan, the surgeon at King's College, tended to his wounds, and with 9 cuts, 6 fractures, a sliced up nose, a split eyelid, and a partially severed ear. Although Marianne had hit him repeatedly about the head with an axe, being blunt, he ended up dazed but not dead. And oddly, with his pain lessened by the soporific excess of booze in his blood, his survival was described as miraculous. Admitted to hospital on the 7th of December 1872, having successfully had bone fragments removed from his brain, on the 11th of December 1872, he identified Marianne as his attacker. And although 2 days later, Daniel Moriarty was dead, Marianne was charged with murder. On the 13th of January 1873, Marianne was tried at the Old Bailey. She was found guilty of manslaughter by provocation and was sentenced to 8 years penal servitude, which she served in Woking Prison. With both of their parents gone, being classed as adults, their eldest children, Mary and Danny, were safe. And although Edward died just a few years later, John and William lived long lives and died as old men. But the same could not be said for the toddler and the newborn. And upon her release, although she would live for another 19 years, as an unskilled, unmarried and penniless ex-convict, having escaped poverty, starvation, famine, alcoholism, abuse and assault, the last days of Mary Ann Moriarty were spent in the Woolwich Union workhouse, where she died in 1901, alone and broken. Her beloved babies cruelly taken from her, having fought to protect them. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. For all minty-flavoured murky milers, there's more flabby gob dribble in the latest Fwar Fest after the break. But before that, here's my recommended podcasts of the week.
I've been listening to a ton of true crime podcasts lately, but you know, there's just not enough conspiracy theories in it.
What about international crime?
But what about the psychological aspect? I mean, what were they thinking?
Yeah, but who's talking about cults and even paranormal stuff?
Hey, wait, that's us. It's Murder Blows. We're a podcast of four friends talking about the things we love the most. Join us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, Overcast, anywhere that you get your podcasts every Monday morning.
And if you haven't gotten enough of us yet, we are on Twitter at Murder Blows and Instagram at Murder Blows Cast.
So come hang out with us or listen to us every Monday. Thanks so much. Bye.
Hi, we're the hosts of the Fresh Hell podcast. I'm Annie in Boston, Massachusetts.
And I'm Johanna in Vienna, Austria. Join us every Wednesday for a new terrible story.
I focus mostly on cases in the US, and not just true crime like the terrifying axe murders on Smutty Nose Island, but also shocking stories like the New Jersey shark attacks of 1916.
And I love to tell you about more obscure European cases. And let me tell you, Germany has produced more cannibals than one would think.
So if you're a fan of true crime, but you also enjoy terrible stories of all sorts, give us a listen. We'll tell you everything you need to know and then some.
Come find Fresh Hell Podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Auf Wiedersehen.
See you soon.
A huge thank you goes out to my new Patreon supporter, who is Richard Fitzpatrick. I thank you, Richard. And a special thank you to George Nasursk, I hope I've pronounced that right, who sent a kind donation to keep the podcast alive via the donate button on the Murder Mile website. George, I thank you. Also, if you don't know, iTunes has finally created a true crime category, and your very own Murder Mile is rocketing up the ranks. Very exciting. But as always, we are battling against some really big shows, many of whom are made by well-funded, professional radio and TV networks, who, even though some of their shows have less than 10 episodes, oddly, they always appear in the iTunes Top 10 charts and on the front page of all of your favourite podcast apps. Why is that? Well, I'll let you into a little secret. They pay for it, and they pay well. Sadly, small independent podcasts like Murder Mile can't afford to blow the money that we don't have on that kind of advertising. I wish we could, but there is a way that you can help, and it's free. If you love Murder Mile and want to keep the show alive, as the more listeners we get, the longer we can keep going. If you can give Murder Mile a review on iTunes and your favourite podcast app, that would really help and would be hugely appreciated. As always, if you want to see what the murder locations look like, every Thursday I upload a blog for each episode with a map, location videos, photos, etc. As always, there's a link in the show notes. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult with No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ah, it's creeped my neck. Oh, ow, shouldn't have turned. Ow, I knew that was going to happen. Oh, I could feel that happening. And then I turned my neck and it just went, oh dear, that hurt. Hey, everyone. Murder Mile again. Murder Mile, Extra Mile. Extra Mile, that's what we're on, isn't it? Extra Mile time. Oh, open windows. Whoa, there we go. Oh, I had something in my throat during that. Right, Extra Mile time. We're going to open some windows and then talk to you. I'm going to do that while I'm doing this. Oh, how are we all? We all good? We all happy? We all busy? All enjoying ourselves? Obviously, if you work in teaching, you're on your holiday and having a great time. If you are the rest of us, you're all working hard. Must be nice to have a nice big summer holiday. I would love that. I think we should all have that, don't you reckon? We should all work the same hours that teachers do. Not denigrating teachers, you all work very hard, but I think we should all have 6 to 8 weeks off over summer and 2 weeks for Easter. That would be great. Although that would be awful. Can you imagine that? Nothing would get done. Everything would be shut. Can you imagine that? For 8 weeks over summer, everything was shut. Maybe we should try it. Let's give it a go. Anyway, right, I'm just in the process of just getting my tea bags. Oh, I don't know what these are. Are these PG? Oh, this is PG. Got a PG tea bag. PG tea bag, some sugar, gonna be done, some powdered milk, as always, because it's summer.
I did have milk before, but it went off, and I had, cheese goes off really fast, it goes all sweaty within a day, it's horrible. So, have I put the gas on? Let me just check that I've just lit the gas. I hope I have. Yes, I've lit the gas. Alright. So I hope you're all well, hope you're all enjoying yourselves. What have I got? Oh, listen to this, look. Chunky Belgian chocolate shortbread. These are going to disappear very quick. Although I am going to have to go on a diet soon. Look at that, I'm like a panda. Panda with giant tits. Oh dear. So that was Extra Mile. That was Murder Mile. Hope you enjoyed that. That was a bit of an emotional one. I enjoyed the little references in there to peat on the fires. Reminds me of my early days growing up in Ireland. The nice peat logs. Always remember the smell of that. Putting the like here's nice having a little log fire, but back in Ireland that was really nice. So you had all the logs and they were made of peat moss, and when you put them on the fire they were quite smoky, but there was a really, really nice smell to them. Oh, I miss that smell. Reminds me of happy days in Ireland. I'm sure it wasn't for my parents. I'm sure it was a horrible time. But for me being young, it was exciting and interesting, and remember the going out on picnics, and I think there was we'd make our own pizzas, and there'd be a special flour that they'd use. I don't know what it was, but yeah, happy days, happy days. So that was where am I? I'm still in the same place I was when with the last week's episode, and I think the week before's episode. I'm not too sure. I can't remember. And because today, I think if you're listening to these episodes when they go out, I'm switching off lights at the moment. You would have just received the Roberto Troyan episode as I'm recording this today. So I'm a couple of episodes ahead. So you've got the Roberto Troyan, and then you'll have the Abominable Mr. and Mrs. Cox. This is not a spoiler, because that would be a week before's episode. And then you have Roberto Calvi, which I'm yet to edit, but I've recorded and written. And then you've got this one. And then what I'm hoping to do before I go away dog sitting for a week, I'm hoping to have written and recorded but not edited the next one, next week's episode, which is good. That was one from the archive, so I've already researched that one. I think I remember sitting there and I've put everything in order anyway. So, but it's one of these interesting murder mystery ones, so we'll see how that goes. So I'm looking forward to that. But I'm just trying to get as many done as possible, so this clears out my August and takes us into September. And by the time I've written next week's episode, that'll be the fifth one in this series of, in this part of 10. What I'm doing now to make things easy for myself is doing blocks of 10, because I can do 10 without getting too far behind and without knackering myself out. So I'm going to start doing blocks of 10, which is what I'm doing, and then it will be like two in the middle, either Meander Mile or Extra Mile or something, and then we go into a block of mini miles. So that's good. This is all to try and make sure that I can keep the quality of the episodes high, but without getting knackered out, which is too easy to do. I do that bit too easy. So, what am I saying? Okay, yeah, no, I'm watching my cup of tea brewing as well. Tea up, tea o'clock, cup of tea. I kind of found this story by mistake. I'd already kind of planned what this block of 10 was going to be. And then I was going through the Old Bailey archive. Many of their old cases are up until 1913 have been digitized and transcribed, which is really useful. So you can go onto the Old Bailey archive. It's very interesting. And I was actually looking for something else. I was looking for a place that I couldn't find, and I knew that if I went on the Old Bailey archive, that if someone lives in that area, that it would describe what streets are off, which weirdly I had to do with this case as well. And as going through the archive, I was looking for a location which was just off Drury Lane. I was trying to find a building, and then I saw woman kills husband with a hatchet in the head in bed, and I was like, sold, I'm interested. Tease up. That instantly caught my attention. I can't beat a cup of tea. All the world's problems could be solved if everybody had tea. Totally believe that. Get everyone in the room, get all the leaders in the room, sit them down, give them a nice cup of tea, maybe a biscuit, and then at the end of it everyone's like, oh, everything's okay. Life is good. Oh yeah, a cup of tea. Lovely, lovely, lovely. So I found that episode and it looked really good. Although I was, this was only probably about 2 weeks ago, so I was already partway through this part of the series already. I knew I needed to do the research quick. I knew it was kind of interesting enough that I could dive into it, but it was a small file and there were many details missing from the file, because it was kind of just like, this is what the police said, this is what Mary Ann said, her husband, blah de blah de blah, she hit him in the head, he was still alive, and then he died. It was a bit of a vague case, but there was enough details in there, the fact that she was, you know, she had 8 children, or 6 as he said, which is interesting. So I thought it could be quite a nice, interesting case, another one about kind of poverty and abuse and things like that. So I went through the Old Bailey file, which was there. Went through there was a Bow Street file, which was at the National Archives. A lot of the files from the Bow Street Police Court are now, they're not digitized, but they're in the National Archives. I had to do a lot more extra research into their back history, which is a real nightmare, because coming from Ireland, a lot of their information is kind of not with us, so I had to find another way of doing that, but I think I did enough to cover what we needed to cover. And then it was interesting, kind of occasionally people would mention about that he had prior convictions, and I was like, that's interesting, it's not in the Old Bailey file. So what I did was I back checked through the Old Bailey files, and there were other crimes that he'd committed, and then there were news articles about things that he'd done previously, and I found details in parish records as well. So that was really interesting. So actually, although the Old Bailey file is pretty basic, actually the further I went back and the more I started checking around people who lived around them as well, the more details I was able to piece together. But I thought this would be an interesting case to throw in there, because obviously I've laid the groundwork in there of something in my eye. Ow! That's annoying. Ow. Get out. Obviously, this is a slightly similar case to the Baker's Wife, the Alexander Moyer episode. So I've kind of laid the groundwork in there before and kind of set the seeds for you in there. So you're kind of going, you hear Baker's Wife, and it's actually only one street over, and the era's not too far away. It's kind of only about 16 years different, and there's a lot of similarities going on with this story, but I had fun writing it, because what I wanted to do was, I thought, okay, we've got these two stories, and you know that with the Baker's Wife, he beats her and beats her and beats her until she's unconscious, and then she dies. It's a really horrific story, but I thought this could be a little bit more fun. Not that this should be a fun story, but play on your expectations of it, that I'm kind of playing with the idea that he's a horrible man, he's brutal, he's horrible, and you just keep thinking that, you know, I keep laying the groundwork that there's an axe and that he's a brutal man and he keeps beating her, and, you know, but actually she does actually get one over on him in the end, and he ends up dead, but she ends up saving her children. But what a cost, what a cost. She ends up in prison, she loses all of her children, she dies in a workhouse. Her children survive. Did a little bit of research on that. Mary Ann went off, got married. Mary was the oldest one. Daniel did really well. He died in his old age. Edward, as mentioned, died in his late 20s. He was a porter in Covent Garden for quite a bit. William, the youngest one, and John both still lived in London up until their 70s. They both died in the 1930s. So they did quite well as well, although the two youngest ones didn't survive. As was the mortality rate in the workhouse, more than 90%, especially if you're younger, under one, your chance of survival was literally zero. But it was a nightmare to find Mary Ann's details and Granby Place as well. This was a pig. This took me a couple of days, which made me think, oh God, I'm not going to be able to do this episode, even though I planned to do this. If you're looking at your maps or phones now, you're probably on Google already as I'm talking and going, Granby Place, Granby Place. What's Michael talking about? It's in Lambeth. It's in SE1. It's not in SE1. Just so you know, there is a Granby Place in SE1, but it's not the Granby Place. It's not this one. And this is the problem, is that Granby Place, where they lived, is on the National Census. It's briefly on the National Census, which is really annoying, but it's not on any maps. It's not on Charles Booth's poverty maps. It's not on parish records. It's not on street maps, but it does exist because it's on the census. And also, really annoyingly, it's listed under multiple names as well. So on the different sources I look at, it's listed under Gramby Place, Gramby Place, Grambly Place. It's like multiple different references which are incorrect. And because it's not on any maps, it was really difficult to try and track down where it was. I knew that it was off. Drury Lane. So what I had to do to find it, I had to use all the statements that people had said, and people said like they went to the Wheatsheaf pub on Vere Street. So I know where Vere Street still exists, and then you had it's not South Street, not Southampton Street. Street I mentioned in there earlier on. Anyway, that's disappeared. I know where that is. I know where Kemble Street is because it's still there today. I know where Wild Street is because it's still there today. I know what direction they were walking. I know what direction they weren't walking because there's lots of different references. And then the people inside their different witness statements, I was able to narrow it down to one small block. And so that was really useful. That was really useful because Drury Lane can be quite big. Obviously, like some of the witnesses said that they were, John Kay said that they lived just 300 feet from Bow Street Police Station. It was off Kemble Street. It was off Drury Lane. So that really narrowed it down to me. So so I've narrowed it down to a block. We can't narrow it down any more than that because basically it was slum housing. It was under a name, but it wasn't its official name. Gramby Place, it looks like it was there for tax purposes or for census purposes, but it never had an official street name, so we know roughly where it is. So that took me a couple of days to find that. That was a real pig, especially when you open up Charles Booth's poverty map and you go, it's not there, even though Booth's poverty map happened after the slum clearances of 1875. So that kind of, all it said is dwellings. And it's like, oh, don't you say dwellings? What's the name of these streets? But they'd all been demolished by that point. So that was a real pig. But finally we got there. It was one of those details I was like, I have to solve this. So I used some of these in here, but I didn't feel that it warranted all of it in there. So these are... Oh, a cup of tea. Lovely. I'm going to read you Daniel's statement. So, Daniel Moriarty's statement. So, 2 days before he died, when he was in King's College Hospital, which is just literally over the road, you've got Covent Garden, you've got the Strand, you've got the Kingsway underpass, which is the old tram system. It's just literally over the road. It's literally a 3-minute walk, if that. Daniel Moriarty was in hospital. He'd had the bone removed from his brain. He was in bed. He was very lucid. He was up and he was walking around. So it actually really did look like he was going to survive. And he said, I lived at 13 Gramby Place, Drury Lane. I was employed at Haggerston Gasworks. Interestingly, he was employed at the same place as the abominable Mr. Cox from 2 episodes ago. On Saturday night, I returned home at 7 o'clock. I then went to Twyman's house. Interestingly, Twyman, I didn't put this in the story, but Twyman is the lady he was having an affair with. Dirty little bugger. In Little Wild Street, which is just off Wild Street, obviously. My wife came after me. I was then quite sober. He loves saying that. My wife and I afterwards went to the Wheatsheaf Public House in Vere Street. We had some drink there. There is references to Mary Ann drinking. I haven't put this in the story because it throws it slightly off. Although some people would say, sometimes people would see her drunk. People would say, firstly, she would only drink with him. And that was kind of her way of keeping an eye on him. She never drank by herself. She was never kind of wandering the streets all pissed up. And if she did drink, it was usually to lessen the pain of the bruises in her body. He said, I had some whiskey. She had some also. We stopped there for about 1/4 hour and then we returned home. I did not go to bed when I got home. There was not a man and his wife in the room when I got back. Whatever that means. My wife and I did not quarrel. Mm-hmm. She struck me with a small axe twice on the left-hand side of the head. It's actually 6 times. I went upstairs to a man. That must be John Kay, but none of this makes sense because John Kay doesn't corroborate this. And he came with me to the hospital. That didn't happen. I did not fall down at all. He did. That is all I know about it. I am certain I did not strike my wife before she struck me. He did. I was sober. He was not. Even when he was in hospital, Andrew Duncan, the hospital surgeon, said he reeked of booze. And because he had so much booze in his system, that was like a pain reliever. The small axe my wife struck me with was in the room at the time. My wife has not been living with me for 3 weeks. It was actually around 9 to 10 days. She went to another place. Yes, she went to another place. The workhouse. And did not come to me for a fortnight. I have been married for 20 years and have 6 children by my wife, 8. I have not been in the habit of ill-using her, which again is bullshit because he was charged with a month with hard labour just a couple of months before for ill-using her. It's amazing how selective his memory was. I didn't put this in the story as well because it kind of slowed it down as well, but George Beals, the landlord and the manager of 13 Granby Place, he lived just 2 doors down at number 11. This throws off the timeline because I don't think the times are right, but at a quarter to 8 o'clock, to 7:45, Marianne Moriarty came into my room very excited and trembling, so that she sat down and then she told me she had hit Mr. Moriarty on the head with a chopper. Throughout this, they use the word chopper or hatchet. I've used the word axe because everybody knows what an axe is. Ooh, burps. I said, "Have you really hit him on the head with a chopper?" She said, "Yes." I said, "With the blade of it?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Whereabouts?" She said, "I don't know, but I've hit him on the head and I think he is dying." I said, "If he dies, you will be in for it." That's another way of saying in trouble. She said, "No, I won't. I only stood in my own defence. Look at me," showing me some bruises on her arms and a lump on her cheekbone. I took a light and went to the house and saw Mr. Moriarty lying on the floor with a sheet around his head, held up by his own hands. That was before the police came. I sent for them and met them coming in. I did not see her any more till she came to me. When she pointed to her arms, there were bruises there. This is when he was being re-examined in the trial. She pointed to a place on her cheekbone where it appeared as if it had been done recently. It was red and turning blue. It appeared to have been a violent blow. It was a goodish sized lump. It was causing her face to swell. When taken away, I like this one. When taken away, as you know, Marianne Moriarty had already confessed to the police. She'd already said, "I'm the one who had done it." When she was being taken away by the police, when she saw that Daniel Moriarty was still alive and that there was a chance that he may still survive, she shouted out, "When I come out, I will do it again." There we go. Marianne Moriarty was sent to the female convict prison in Woking in Surrey, in Knapp Hill. Interestingly, Woking prison in Surrey was also the same place that Alexander Moyer, the brutal baker, was sent to. Only he was sent to, obviously, the male part, not the female part, because they'd split it. That was closed in 1895. And it was the first purpose-built female convict prison. Opened in 1869. What else do we have? Yes. Have I used this? Let's use this. Prisoner's statement before the magistrate. Ah, yeah, this is Marianne Moriarty's statement in court. So, I've used bits of this, but not all of it. I have been his wife for 21 years and the mother of his 8 children. See, she can get it right. I have been a very good mother, she has. But I am sorry to say that my husband behaved a very great brute and a very great drunkard to me. I had to take my children in my arms and go in the street of a night from him. I have always been in and out of the workhouse with them. My husband turned me out and kept me in the streets. The last accident took place. He was all the week drinking. So the week before the murder happened, he was boozing all week. As we know, he always boozes all week. And he left his work. He drew the last of his money on Wednesday and came home that evening drunk and was in a very bad temper. He asked for some dinner. I gave it to him. He seemed all evening in a very bad temper. I tried to amuse him all I could. Between 5 and 6 o'clock, a man named Dwyer, I think his name was Tom Dwyer, I believe, came and asked my husband to assist him with some potatoes into the cellar. I briefly mentioned this in this episode. I may be editing it out, I don't know. My husband was sitting by the fire drunk. He turned around to me and said, "What brought Dwyer up here?" I said, he came for your assistance with some potatoes. My husband said, no, he did not. And he said he came for a very bad purpose, implying sexual shenanigans, which is kind of ironic given the fact that this is coming from Daniel Moriarty, who's a womanizer and uses prostitutes. A brothel botherer. Many words passed between us, and he got up and beat me around the head. I cried out very loud, but no one came to me. He kicked me with his bare feet. He then dressed himself and went out. I went out afterwards, and I went and told Dwyer what my husband had said. I did not go into the room again except when my husband was out. He was all week this drunk up to Saturday. He was all the week drunk up to Saturday. Right. All week he was drunk up till Saturday. He lay in bed with his clothes on. On the Sunday morning, he took a lamp and other things to sell. I took out this. There was references to pawn tickets. They were so broke that they were having to use pawn tickets to make the money. But really, Daniel was just using the pawn tickets to buy more booze. He did not come home till late. He got up early on the Monday morning. He said he would not come home till late. He came home in the evening between 6 and 7 o'clock, and I left the room. I was with my children all day. He worked up until Friday night, so that's the night before, 5 days a week. He came home on the Friday night about 9 o'clock. I went out, and a little afterwards, my husband went to the public house. My third son, which we've mentioned here, was Edward, I believe, followed him there and asked him for some money for some bread, which we've put in the story. After that, my husband sent a child for me for 2 pawn tickets, and I sent them to him. He went upstairs to... Oh, this is all about Kay's room. This is all about... This gets up to the point where he goes upstairs to John Kay's room. They're doing some boozing. Where's this bit? The horrible man is washing his shitty boat. You know the horrible man I mentioned last time, who has the lights on all night blinding us, and uses his little remote control boat to scare the ducks because he's a prick. He's washing his boat, but he doesn't go anywhere in his boat, which is really annoying. It just sits outside his house and he cleans it, but he doesn't go anywhere. Really pointless. On the Saturday morning, I saw my husband washing himself in the room. He sent the boy for some coals. He gave him no money for the bread. When my husband went out, I went up to the room. After that, I went to look for my husband and found him in the yacht public house having rum and water. I went next to Twyman's, which is the pub where his fancy lady was in Wild Street, and there I saw him sitting down with the woman Twyman, as she called her. I asked him if that was the way he was going to treat me. He laughed at me. He got up and took me to Callahan's, which was another pub. I haven't mentioned that in, because I couldn't find out where Callahan's was. 6 months ago, he took this woman up to my room and sent my children out. Naughty, naughty, shaggy, shaggy. After leaving Callahan's, we went home, and my husband lay on the bed in his things. I sat down and went to sleep. When I awoke, I've took this out as well, because it kind of, it doesn't make sense. When I awoke, it was dark. I went to the room where my husband was, and he beat me around the head. I got from him and went to the Bow Street police station. This is, we've put this all in the story, and saw the inspector. Interestingly, the inspector, when they quizzed the inspector said that there was no reference or record of her turning up that day to go to Bow Street police station and making a complaint against her husband. She went there and said that to ask the police to send for her husband so they could charge him, but the husband decided he didn't want to go. Husband said, Daniel said, have you been to Bow Street as usual? I'll give you cause to go there. He threw me from the door towards the fender, which is part of the fire. The chopper was against the fender. He said, I'll do for you now. He picked the chopper up. I threw myself on his arm and wrenched the chopper out of his hand. He dragged me towards the door and I hit him twice on the head. I saw him bleeding and went to Mr. Beale's, the deputy's place, it's George Beale's. I gave my husband, as I had given my husband, a month's imprisonment about 8 months ago. There were more statements, but this was just one that I thought I hadn't used it much, so we'll throw that in there so you can hear her voice. Right, tired now. Barely even touched my cup of tea. Look at it, it's sitting there. Tea, cake. I'm going to get this. I'm going to go to Costa now. Oh, I'm going to prep the next episode. Oh, dear. And then hopefully, what have I got? Thursday today, I'm going to try and write some of it today. I've got Friday, I've got Saturday, I've got tours on Sunday. So hopefully I won't be able to do much. Monday, and then hopefully hopefully I can record episode 72 on Tuesday morning before I go to my brother's. Whew, it's all go, isn't it? Right, that was Murder Mile episode 71. Hope you enjoyed it. Boat's about to go past. Man on his phone, not paying attention, but there we go. Hope you enjoyed that. More episodes to come. It's all going well. We're not going off tangent. No one's threatened to sue me yet, which is good, even if they do. I'm all hardened up now. Don't care. Bring it on. Bring it on, dickheads. I do my research. That's episode 72. Hope you enjoy it. And there'll be more episodes next week. Have yourself a good one. Tatty bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.